Kev Malcolm.
Hello.
Here we go again.
Yeah, back in the studio, back in the hot seats.
It's June.
Yeah.
It's hot.
You can feel it outside.
And it's storm season.
Yes.
No, we don't talk about that yet. Fake news. Hey, speaking of fake news. I'd like to explore.
Fake news.
Yes, I'd like to explore this
fake
subject.
News?
Oh, okay, I've heard of this.
So here's a question.
Clearly, you have it on your mind.
I do, because there's a lot of it, apparently.
Yes,
and it's hard to discern which is which. But here's a question I have for both of you. Do you believe in UFOs? Is there alien life somewhere else?
Oh, definitely.
You seem very convinced of this.
Shannon looks
like she's caught in a headlight.
Well, I do believe it. I just don't know if they've visited here and if Area 51 has a thing with bodies in it.
Yeah.
But I do believe that there's life outside of our world.
Yeah, space is a big
thing. Makes us so special? We're the only ones.
What is this based on? Do you have any empirical evidence whatsoever?
The National Enquirer.
Fake news. Okay. National Enquirer. Let me ask you the next question. Do you believe?
That's a good one.
Do you believe
especially considering our guest that's coming up.
Right.
Do you believe in Yetis?
Oh.
You think there's a Bigfoot out there?
Probably. I've seen a blurry photo or two.
In my younger years, I probably met some
You've
on the
seen...
slopes.
On the slopes.
Or dated a few. you've seen visual evidence? How do you know this visual evidence is real?
You know, because it's like, it's got a date on it, so.
Yeah. But what's the difference between a Yeti and a Bigfoot?
The photo has a date on it?
Yeah, so you know it was really taken.
Thank God we have our guest today. JFK, lone gunman?
No way.
I stood in the Texas Book Depository and looked down. It does not seem possible that someone could have gotten a shot on.
Yeah, no grassy knoll.
No.
It's just really tricky. Yeah. So you believe yay, nay?
I don't believe there was one gunman because I've been there too. And I'm like, there is no way this is some magic crap right now.
And this is a question for you.
What?
Lady Di, conspiracy?
Oh.
So I've always questioned it. But then I went to London, and one of our games in the cabs was to survey our driver, whether it was a cab or I forget what they call it. It's kind of like our Uber. I'm going to go with
they call them
yes.
a cab.
No, they don't. It's an Uber. It's a different name. It's a different company name.
Double-deckers.
But anyway.
They say it with an accent. It's an Uber.
No, it's something else. It's like a Bumble or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I don't think Bumble's it.
Most every single one. What do you mean? It
Come
could
on.
Be. Anyway, so most every single driver said absolutely it was a conspiracy. And part of the big reason is because who she decided to align her life with.
Yeah.
I think there's a different reason. I think there's a different reason. You're largely with working class folks in a cab who are much more likely. So... let's talk a little bit about newspapers and news. Like, where did you get your news growing up, aside from cab drivers in London?
I see.
Come on. It was better than the Enquirer.
Regular subscriber.
So, definitely the newspaper. So, for me, okay, now I'm going to be transparent. I am a digital person, but it evokes warmth and love for me because my dad would sit with the paper with his cup of coffee and my mother-in-law, Hannon mother-in-law, because, you know, I've done it a few times. But anyway, the Hannon mother-in-law.
We're trying to keep up.
Yeah, I'm helping you out with this one. But my Hannon mother-in-law, it's like if you would come in the morning, she was with her paper, her coffee, she had her piece of toast, and it was just like a ritual for folks. And I think... you know, we're talking about fake news. I think that's a huge deal. But I think we've lost that ritual of making sure we checked in with our news.
Yeah. Well, we've certainly moved away
from...
it's
really noisy.
I think I'm the oldest one in the group. But we had...
No.
You're not that far behind. Let's just be clear. But we had one newspaper... and then we had three news stations, and that was it. We had three TV stations.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, we had a fourth because I was in the Northeast. We had an independent, but we had three TV stations.
Turn the dial four clicks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and you had to sit down.
My father sat in the chair and said, "Son, please go change the channel." I was the channel. Right. I was the remote control.
So I'm young enough that I didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And it was color because I think we've had a show where you said that black and white.
I remember the very first time The Unsinkable Molly Brown is the first movie I ever saw in color. Big deal.
Oh.
All right. Yeah. Speaking of big deals.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I'm so excited about our guest today.
Mm-hmm.
So do the honors. You do the introductions. Let's roll.
No, that's really your part of the show.
No.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to do the introduction. So we have the big cheese at the local newspaper here with us today. one of the most esteemed people in our community. Welcome to the show, Connor Gallaty.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Yeah. Ev, Shannon,
round of applause.
You.
Okay, so tell us.
Do you believe in UFO? Do you believe in aliens?
I do.
Do you really?
I do.
Okay,
actually, there was
over.
Just news about this, right? No, seriously, there was just news. 124 million light years away, they have discovered an exoplanet outside of a red dwarf.
Who is they?
Those underground NASA scientists, right?
Is that kind of like the women that went up in space? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes.
And that were worried about their hair.
That has chemical signals of life, right? It's what they call, it's some sort of water planet that has a hydrogen atmosphere, and the same hydrogen signals actually come from algae that we find on this planet. So, supposedly, there could be life on that planet.
That's awesome.
I don't think it's a green guy, but there
is life. Want to point out that his research was materially better than the two of you.
What?
He had informed.
He runs a newspaper.
Yeah.
I work here.
All right. Well, that answers a whole lot.
And there we go.
I do believe in UFOs.
Yeah.
Right? It's interesting. Did you ever see the movie Contact?
I did.
Which I thought was a fabulous movie.
Right. Yeah.
I thought the way in which the premise was presented, I found myself thinking, right? That was interesting to me, the idea that somehow, right, in the way that it shaped out.
Carl Sagan, ahead of his time in so many ways, not only scientifically, but from a study of human behavior, just understood how people relate to science.
Yeah.
Wonderful man.
Yeah.
Although, can we agree Matthew McConaughey in that role was just awesome?
Just hot. Just hot.
No,
my wife thinks he's smoking hot.
He looks hot. He sounds hot. Yeah. It's all of it. But my personal favorite is Independence Day.
That's a good one. You get to play
that. I'm sorry. That's a cool one.
Now, that is scientifically sound.
Jeff Goldblum,
right?
All day. Yeah.
All right.
The Fourth of July was forever changed.
So I'm personally really excited to have you here today.
Thank you.
You know, as Shannon was talking about, and you and I have spoken about this privately, I grew up on newspapers and news. I've shared the story before, I think, but one of the most impressionable memories I have as a kid is 10 years old, my mother watching the Watergate hearings all summer. And it was a really important moment in our country, though that recent events may make that different, but it was a really important moment. But what that impressed upon me then was her love of news and information and the responsibility she had to read about it, understand it. We were a newspaper home. It always came to the doorstep. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just really excited to talk about news today, where we are, where we're headed. So thank you for coming and spending some time with us.
My pleasure. I'm always excited to talk about this topic.
Yeah.
And that Watergate moment, I think that was a seminal moment in the relationship between U.S. citizens and its media and its government.
Yeah.
And in fact, I know you're supposed to be asking me questions. Let me ask you a
question.
That's
okay. This is a conversation.
Yeah.
So one thing that I hope the folks that watch this know, but in case they don't, the Tampa Bay Times is owned by the Poynter Institute, right? A school for journalists. And this year is the 50th anniversary for the Poynter Institute. It was created in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing a list of the 50 most important moments in journalism since 1975.
Ooh.
On that list, right, is not necessarily the Watergate scandal, although it's a big story. It was actually the movie All the President's Men.
Great movie.
Right?
Even better book.
Right. Yeah. And so the idea is come up with a list of the events in our history over the last 50 years that had an impact between journalism and its citizens.
Hmm.
Can you name another one just in the top five? Not news events, but events that changed the relationship between journalism and the citizens.
So we're talking 50 years. So we're talking 1975 on.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a really good question that I feel stumped by.
Maybe something around Edward Snowden?
Edward Snowden would be on the list, okay. Absolutely.
Right, WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks, yeah.
Yeah.
Here's one. The O.J. car chase.
Oh, yeah.
So you would consider that journalism, but photojournalism.
A version of journalism, right?
Yes.
Because how many of us watched that live as there was flying through the streets of L.A. in the white Bronco, right? And just the idea that news coverage would be in the moment as it was happening, and the conversation was happening around that news event.
What's interesting, one of the questions that we ask in different forum is, what's the seminal event in your life? Like, what's the first thing that you remember that is a international, national? So some people will mention Princess Di.
Yeah.
Some people will mention the OJ trial. Mm-hmm. Like, most people remember where they were when they heard the verdict.
Right.
Right, it's one of those things that you still pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
We all
crash,
said what together.
Right, that one comes up often.
Yeah. It's but it is interesting how people attach. You kind of sometimes you think about songs. We talked about movies a moment ago that kind of tell you where your life was.
Mm-hmm.
Right, news events. Right, those moments where you first heard those things become markers in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not just markers to a person, but markers as a community. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. We can all remember the moment when certain things happened if we have a shared experience around it, right? Mm-hmm. And news, traditional news, has always been to a mass audience so that we all, even if we watched a different channel or may have read a different newspaper, we all got the sense that this was a major story of the day.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that's change.
Yeah, and it's, I know we want to find out a little bit about Cotton, but you know, it's a really interesting thing. How do you, as a news person, know when that event, some are so big that you know 9/11, but how do you tend to have a sense of whether something's going to catch the attention of a community?
Oh, that's a great question. There it's a wide variety, right? Sometimes there's news that's incredibly important because it can shape our society going forward. There's news that we just know is going to be highly interesting, right? Mm-hmm. There are some crimes, for example, because of the perpetrator of the crime or the victim of the crime, they just have a gravitas about them that people are going to want to pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mixed bag. Sometimes you just realize this is going to have a dramatic impact, and sometimes you realize this is just going to draw a lot of attention.
Do you think that you tell the story or create the story?
Oh, we always try to tell the story, but there's no doubt the creation of it really always comes into play. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, you try to always be the observer, always to chronicle the history of the moment, but it's a human endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the effect of the person who is doing that chronicling, who's doing that telling, that their views, their biases, the way they approach what is important, what's real, what's true, affects that.
Well, and I guess, you know, thinking about Ev, who is part of Ev's job description, a storyteller, right? And how you walk into a subject's life and capture it effectively, but not alter it.
Yeah, I did a journalism master's at USF St. Pete. And one of the things that I struggled with a lot was keeping yourself out of it, because you are you. It's very hard to keep your history and your feelings and your thoughts about it out of the reporting, but that's the goal.
And Ev, you probably, you know, if you studied the journalism history throughout that master's course, you know, it hasn't always been that way, right? You go back 100 years and journalism very much was from the point of view of the storyteller, of the journalist covering that event. Right. It really has only been, I'd say, since the 1930s and up until recently that most journalism tried for objectivity, tried to take the journalist away from the story and tell it independently.
I swear to God, we're going to ask you questions about you. But
I want to ask a question. Is there anything in your career, you've been doing this a long time, right? We're going to back up Southern Gentlemen because you've been in the South, right, for a long time. But I want to know this topic that we're talking about. Was there any story that blindsided you, like you could not believe this went big?
Mm. Well, that's a good question.
You know, we're pretty good at this.
I like the stumpers. That's good. That's good. And a story that I couldn't believe went as viral as I might have thought. When I think about all of the stories were told during the pandemic, right? One of the reoccurring themes was from, you know, the views inside of hospitals. And as we were covering, even local hospitals, we had a team that went into Morton Plant, for example, and spent a week, you know, talking to the nurses, the doctors, the patients, you know, about
the families
about what they were going through. Yeah. And what really stood out to me from a kind of a virality aspect is the times that people would, you know, plead to others, hey, you know, I should have taken more precautions, right? And just seemingly that would be so obvious to say. I mean, these are people who were dying even though they had respirators, right? And they weren't going to make it. And the fact that not that that story wouldn't go far and wide, but that the alternate view of it, mm-hmm. that these people yeah. were lying in the moment, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. that spread, yeah. right? There's yeah. here that we fabricated it, that we just staged yeah. in some studio, yeah. right? I mean, that's what was so sad about trying wow. to do that really tough storytelling.
You go back to, in a similar vein, there are still people that don't believe we landed on the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or we're right? flat.
Right.
That gets me. The earth is flat.
It's right, easier to take off from.
But, yeah. but it's interesting. That went to a degree that none of us, it's a great answer to the question, because that went to a degree that none of us and would ever have anticipated would get legs, because people were legitimately ill, legitimately dying.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy when something reveals itself and you go, wow, I just did not, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that, I remember watching, it was the Knicks-Rockets championship game and they broke in with OJ. At that moment, the car chase, you would never have had any idea that that story would capture the size and scope for the next, 15 months?
Yeah.
18 Easily. Months? It became Easily. A national obsession.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have known in that moment when Al Cowlings is trucking along whatever it is, right? OJ hiding in the back.
Right. You know who I am.
right? That right. would become such a part of human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. But...
yeah.
Conan.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to our guest for a second. Although this has been a great conversation.
Yeah, it has.
So, of course, we just did a little homework, but we want to learn a lot about you. So, we're going to dive into digital. You know a lot about that. So, I think the Times is in great hands, switching wherever you need to. But you're from the South.
I am.
Tell us a little about where you grew up and where you lived.
So I'm from a tiny town in northwest Georgia called Rome.
Hmm.
Rome, Georgia, because this town has three rivers and seven hills. Other than that, it's nothing like Rome, Italy.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Is it Rome apples?
No. There are not apples there either. No. Lots of peanuts, though. Lots
yeah,
of peanuts.
Yeah, peanuts are everywhere.
When I was in school, I worked at a peanut factory. Actually made the peanuts for Delta Airlines.
Oh.
So, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, that was you.
Yeah, that was me. That was me. So if you enjoyed those peanut Sweet packages crunch. On your flight, you can thank me. Rome was a great little town to grow up in, just about an hour outside of Atlanta.
Okay.
I spent most of my childhood there, and then mm-hmm. ended up attending the University of Georgia, studied journalism,
mm-hmm.
And has been all throughout the Southeast at different media publications.
Who mm-hmm. influenced you? How did you choose journalism?
You really want to know the answer to
this? I do. We always want to know the answer.
This isn't being recorded, right?
No.
So,
both audio and visual, but that's okay. Go ahead.
So I think it's a girl.
Yes. It was actually gets a little stranger than this. It was a woman. I was in seventh grade and I had a
this
crush.
This is a G-rated show.
I know. Yes. I know. It doesn't get too bad. I was in seventh grade and I had a crush on my math teacher, Ms. Jacobs. And Ms. Jacobs was also the sponsor of the yearbook and the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And she one day said, "Hey, I need some of you students to volunteer to serve on the staff of these publications."
Okay.
Raise my hand.
Me.
I said, "This sounds great."
And this is junior high, so you were the editor in chief in
I mean,
senior,
I was, yeah, I forget what the role
school.
Was. Yeah. And I mean, I thought we did exceptional work. It was Pulitzer Prize winning material.
Yes.
Yeah, we got shunned by the judges. But
Ms. Jacobs.
Yeah, Ms. Jacobs.
Ms.
Yeah,
Jacobs. Yeah. That was the swerve.
Man.
Yeah, yeah.
She was
so
hot.
So, Angela
wow.
Jacobs, if you're listening to this, thank you
thank
for inspiring
you.
My career
thank
in journalism.
You.
You've done wonders.
Wow. Wouldn't that be funny?
Right, yeah, yeah. But no, beyond that, I really, what I love, though, and this is kind of a, you know, an ode to journalism and just kind of, you know, chronicling history, mm-hmm. is that I just realized how interesting it is to, you know, try to write down what happened today, what happened this week, what happened this mm-hmm. year, which, you know, is what a school yearbook does or, mm-hmm. you know, a newspaper does. And as, you know, poor form as it was back then, and, you know, I've actually have a box in my closet at the house of all these old yearbooks and newspapers.
Whoa.
And you go through yeah. it and it's like, oh, this is terrible. I can't believe we created these things.
Yeah,
and
but when you
around.
Published it, everyone loved it.
Exactly.
They were waiting. They paid in advance.
Right.
I mean, that's very cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so trying to capture a moment, trying to remember what happened, what was the most mm-hmm. important thing that that happened to you today, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's got a different version of that. Even if we spent all day together and we tried to write down, you know, the, what happened today that was really important, mm-hmm. we'd all have different answers.
Yeah.
And so I think the what inspired me from you know, junior high through high school, through college, was that it was just a really interesting thing. And I've never lost interest in it. Mm-hmm. Right?
This is that's amazing.
30 years in the business, I've never lost interest in that.
And what made you choose University of Georgia? Proximity?
Proximity. Growing up in Georgia, there was
I was going to say, you grew up in Georgia. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So it's great.
You weren't going to UF.
Don't
assault
me.
No. Or FSU.
And actually, all fairness, I mean, as much as we were rivals in sports, University of Florida has such a great journalism program. Mm-hmm. And the Alligator, the independent student newspaper, has done some amazing work. Amazing work.
Just ask Ben Sasse. But that's an aside.
Yeah, yeah. So, but they're keeping the torch lit, which is wonderful to see. And we're always pleased to watch journalism schools put out just wonderful people. That you know that keep moving forward in this great endeavor. Mm-hmm.
So journalism, but when you like if I'm trolling your LinkedIn as I did, digital, that was it's always been for the most part your titles have included digital for a long time. Tell us about that. How did you move from telling the story to digital?
Yeah, so I had the good fortune of graduating from the University of Georgia in the mid 90s. Right when most publications were just starting to experiment with digital publishing. Mm-hmm. And they knew that it was going to be something. They didn't know how big it was going to be, but most of them had a sense that this was going to be likely the next generation of how people got their news and information. One of the misperceptions about my industry is that we were asleep at the wheel, that we loved our printed products, we loved putting ink on paper too much, and we didn't think that digital journalism was going to last. We thought it was a fad. Mm. Completely untrue. All the companies I've worked for from the beginning of my career understood that this was really what the future was going to look like. Mm. Just didn't know how fast it would come.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And more importantly, didn't know how it was going to fund the journalists.
Right. It was the monetization issue that ultimately was challenging for y'all to figure out.
In 2025, we were still trying to figure that out.
Well, and the horse got out of the barn quick, as you said.
It did. It did. It was a slow burn, and then it was a sudden acceleration, right? Yeah. When I joined the industry in the mid-90s, things were still booming. I mean, it was a very lucrative business to be in. Fast forward to the mid 2000s, around 2005, right about the time of the recession, and that's when the wheels came off. That's when you had so many disruptors that were taking pieces and parts of what the newspaper bundle was, specifically the classified section, where you had a lot of advertising that paid for a lot of journalism that we did. That started to get disrupted, moved to Craigslist, moved to different job sites, right? All of those categories were really funded a ton of positions in the newsroom. So we had to figure out a different way to fund those.
Yeah, the model, I think, as you said, you know, shifted dramatically. But also talk to us about how the consumer shifted. What was the expectation of your consumer base? What were they telling you? I remember there was a point in my life where I never thought I would be without a physical paper. But I, too, eventually gave up a physical paper. How did you understand what your consumers wanted and how to move your business towards meeting that demand? I'm sure it's an ongoing conversation, but that's a revolution that's taking place, and y'all are trying to figure out how to step into that.
Yeah, it very much is. And I think what we are finding is that it is not just one thing, one format that consumers want. You know, just like the advertising side of the business changed slowly and then almost all at once, the same thing on the consumer side, right? We had a number of people who appreciated the fact that outside of a 24-hour news cycle where we would publish once a day, they could get breaking news instantly, right? And we jumped on that. We had some wonderful breaking news operations that we could compete with television stations that could break in the middle of programming. A newspaper couldn't do that.
Right.
Well, suddenly with the web, we could. And so we started to amass an audience, and we thought, okay, we're going to have this giant newspaper and a giant website and digital products to serve an even bigger audience. So the sky was the limit. And what happened over time was that traditional side of the business began to shrink as more and more audience said, I want this news, but I want it digitally. I don't want to put my hands around a physical paper. Mm-hmm. I want my news when I want it in the format that I want it.
So There's a lot of parody on certain social channels today about leakers. Who's a leaker most likely to call today, a newspaper or a TV station?
That's a really great question. We do still have a number of great connections, contacts.
Shannon's the leaker here. By
I was gonna suggest Ev, but I'm plugged in.
We'll talk afterwards.
Yeah.
So we do, but we also know that social channels not only give a platform for the people that we quote, but also for the people that want to share information, right? And so we know that we have to be on those channels. We have to be accessible. We have a number of different formats that we do that in. There are a number of people that will never talk to us, face to face or even over the phone. So we have channels that are completely encrypted, where people anonymously can send us information. This especially becomes important for people in government positions where they have access to data, and they know that a lot is on the line if they are found providing information outside of what they're supposed to do. So we've had a number of incidents that have come around. You probably read our coverage, hopefully you read our coverage about the program in the state parks where they were going to install golf courses and pickleball courts. That was provided by a government employee who had read some proposals and realized this is not good. The public needs to be able to weigh in on this. Thankfully they contacted us. We were able to get that information and provide some great journalism that created important legislation and still in the works. But those are the kinds of connections that we have to maintain in a variety of formats, not just deep throat meeting you in the in a parking garage, right? It takes all forms.
Wow.
I have a lot of other questions about this, but I know we have a few other areas we cover.
If you want to flow with it.
Let me ask you this question. We're going to talk about the Fourth Estate in a few minutes, but just on the topic that you're talking about, you don't have to register your opinion, but is an Edward Snowden a hero or a villain in the story?
It's tough to assign motivation to people that release, information that they know they shouldn't or their superiors say they shouldn't, right? I think what is important with the information that someone like Snowden has is the ultimate use of it, right? We don't publish everything we get. We get information sometimes that we know is not in the public interest, that only serves to, do harm and not good. And so part of the journalistic process is to make sure you don't move too quickly, right? And it's a tough one because sometimes there are things, and there have been plenty of incidents across the country for major national publications where they received military information and they were smart enough to realize that lives were on the line. Yeah. They may, build business and, sell more subscriptions or get more advertising if they were to put out this, this bombshell report, but they also knew there was a bigger harm and they hold back. Great example, if you don't mind. Signalgate, right? So the editor for the Atlantic, was accidentally included on this group chat on Signal, encrypted, but certainly not a government channel, and initially held back all the information that he had, knowing that if this was if these were war plans, the last thing he wanted to do was share them and put our own service members in harm's way. Once the government came out and said, no, none of this was confidential information, he said, okay, here's everything we said.
Yeah.
So to follow up the question, I'm sure the answer would still be we wouldn't share this, but what might a listener think would fall into the realm of something you wouldn't publish? Is it information about someone? I guess it's probably D, all the above. What would cause you to say, we just don't feel comfortable that it's the right thing to do or in the public interest to not publish? What would be an example of that? Again, without revealing, obviously.
But let's say you had a member of public office and there were issues with their children. Right.
Gotcha.
Those are the things that doesn't serve the public interest. It could harm the child's life. Yeah. I mean, or be injurious to them in a multitude of ways. There's no ethical reason to publish something like that.
But please.
Nope. We're learning how to communicate together. What about, so that's very ethical decisions. Those are very thoughtful and you're protecting, but there are so many out there who are not. Mm-hmm. Like there are so many that, you know, be damned, I'm going to have clicks and I'm going to sell this and I'm going to sell that. How does the public navigate where to trust their mm-hmm. news? Well, whether that be on your local level, because everything you're telling me is stuff that should be interesting to me. I know you guys have a commitment to the community. You're helping us learn things that we'll get to, but how do you know the difference?
Yeah. So how Americans trust the sources of their news, that's yeah. a big question. And I think that we can jump into that. It'll be a longer answer, but to think about why we choose to mm-hmm. be very ethical in what we release, it's really about our mission of trying to make the community a better place. And I know that sounds trite, right? But we really do believe in it. And trying to bring up salacious details mm-hmm. that only serve, you know, to balloon some sort of immediate draw right. to a story that doesn't actually improve the community.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, yeah. I mentioned like children in a family that need protection. You might have an elected official who has an affair, right? Or some cause of a divorce. There is no need for us yeah. to go into the salacious details yeah. of that, right? The fact was these people are not going to be together anymore. Right. And we don't need to expose all those dirty laundry, right?
How does that affect us, right? Mm, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, Conan gave us a nice segue there to talk about what is the Times' purpose?
Right.
What's your mission? What's your...
Yeah. Your yeah. vision, your mission as an organization.
Yeah. So we are here to build a better Tampa Bay. And that we live by that mission. We try to serve the community in a multitude of ways underneath that umbrella mission. You know, one is that we try to make the institutions essential to our society, essential to our community, as strong as possible. And this is one of those areas where people have a grand misunderstanding of what journalists do when it comes to covering institutions, right? If you go to the mayor's office, if you go to the sheriff's office, if you talk to the heads of school districts or, you know, law offices or, you know, the county judges, you know, are the media their friends? Well, they might think no, based off of the way that we cover them and look for areas that are concerning. But the underlying goal for us is to make sure those institutions are run by the smartest, most ethical people we can find. Right. And that anyone that would dare injure those institutions by acting in a way that was unethical or outside the standards of what we expect, what citizens expect, mm-hmm. we will call them out. Mm-hmm. That's the watchdog part of our mission, is that we're not out to, you know, destroy a sheriff's office. We're not out to ruin a school district. We want to make sure they are fantastically run. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that really is our mission on how we serve.
But you're also here on campus today volunteering.
Yes.
We are. Yeah, yeah. Happy to volunteer. Thanks for having us today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have about 2 dozen volunteers downstairs mm-hmm. Putting together boxes of food, and they're mm-hmm. happy to do it.
Yeah. So I think the conversation that continues to bounce around in the back of my mind, and we've come back to this a few times, is, you know, the evolving nature of journalism and where it's headed. You know, before we ask Conan, maybe we'll ask you.
Sure.
So you got into journalism for a particular reason.
You can't make money as a poet, it turns out. Yeah, you have to go to journalism school to get a job.
I knew that was coming.
Not a lot of money in journalism either, buddy.
Sorry. That's why I'm here. No.
So how have you observed the changes in media and journalism since the day you walked into the school versus now having spent time in the community?
Yeah, some of my professors were like old beat reporters from way back. Like, yeah, one of my teachers was like a 75-year-old who his first computer could hold like 10 megabytes of memory, and he would talk about how
which isn't a lot.
It's, I don't know.
very small
sense
amount
of proportion yeah, about this
word processor. But you know, he would talk about the time that would go into stories back then. You know, like if you had something coming from an embassy overseas, it might be written a week before it comes out, and all the time spent traveling, you're like developing that and confirming things. And now it really is like, I heard about this thing, put it on Twitter. Like it's incredibly fast because of the evolution of the 24-hour news cycle and digital things like that. And also the attention span and the absorption for people shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And so getting a full story across with all of the impacts and all of the implications is harder and harder because people don't go for that anymore. They want the quick hits. They want the information right now. They want the headlines. And that really is a disservice, I think, to people.
So I was going to ask, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, it's one of the, they would talk about it a lot in the program about how, like Marshall McLuhan, media is the message. Like, we live in a digital age. We function digitally. We process quickly. So in a way, it helps in the world we live in. I personally think that it's a negative because it is a lot of breadth and very little depth. We know very little about anything that we're receiving.
Interesting. What do you think about all that?
I think Ev's absolutely right. We live in an attention economy, mm-hmm. right? And that attention is sold in nickels and dimes, mm-hmm. right? You think about who are the people that are most influential right now and with their influence rising.
Yeah.
It's those that can grab our attention in small bite-sized chunks. Right. Rarely is it someone who can go very deep and thoughtfully into a topic. And I think some of the best work that we do is our investigative and deep enterprise mm-hmm. work. And sadly, it's some of the hardest work to have a positive economic return on. I'll give you a good example. So a couple of years ago, we did a really great investigative piece on a lead smelter, the only lead smelter here in Florida. And our investigation showed through thousands of medical documents that the workers in that plant weren't provided proper ventilation equipment, right? Respirators, the things you have to have because there's all kinds of heavy metals in the air. They take these batteries and crush them and it releases lead mm-hmm. and arsenic and cadmium and things you don't want to inhale. Mm-hmm. And they weren't inhaling them because the company wasn't providing enough equipment. And OSHA, right, who you'd think would be showing up, hadn't shown up in 5 years.
Mm. Oh, wow.
So we did a great investigation, took these journalists over a year and a half, thousands of documents poured through, talking to medical experts. That enterprise work, that investigation won us a Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
But when we looked at the numbers, how many people actually read through the whole story, how many people subscribed because of it, mm-hmm. right? Didn't even get close to paying for itself.
Wow.
That makes me so sad. Do you know who did Helen, that's the food critic
from
at the
California.
Time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She broke away and you realize she's not there. And she did an investigative report.
On Kratom.
Yes. Mm. I actually text her. I'm like, this is wonderful. The time and effort that you put into this. This is like art.
Context. What's the story?
So the story is about, it's supposed to be a natural drug, if you will, that people are taking, but they're being destroyed by it. And how many months was she just out of pocket and doing all the investigations and interview? It was just so amazing and so well written and done and impactful. And I know her as the food critic, but I was so impressed mm-hmm. that I texted her. I'm like, this is a beautiful piece.
Yeah, it was amazing work. It took almost a year for the team. It was Helen and a number of great journalists that collaborated on this project. But if you drive down the street and you see these Kratom signs, mm-hmm. like kind of in neon and in little shops, it's all about that plant, which comes from the Philippines, right? And has been used for hundreds of years, thousands of years even, as a natural herb to cure pain, right? Mm-hmm. But it's brought over here and crushed and synthesized into a very, very high dosage. Mm. And there's no regulation on it.
Yeah.
So when you go into these stores and you buy this for pain relief, and a lot of people that are suffering from opioid addiction use it, you know, as self-medication, they don't know what they're getting. And the whole story was about, why is it that there is no regulation on this?
Right.
And where is this product coming from? Who's creating strong doses?
Yeah. It was wonderful.
But to your point, same exact effect where the work wasn't paid for by the people that
brought
it. How do you?
But it's art. It's incredible.
Right. And that, you know, how do you balance that as having the responsibility to run I assume they want you to run a profitable enterprise over there.
We do.
So we do our best. Thing.
Is that that's the goal?
Yeah.
How do you decide whether to let a journalist pursue something versus resource, time, opportunity? How do you make that that decision. Yeah. It's got to be tough.
It is a tough decision. It's tough to put a limit on that work, yeah. right? I mean, look, you all do amazing work in the community, but you can only do as much as the money allows
we're
you
capable
to do,
of,
right?
Yes.
I mean, you'd love to go 10 times further, mm-hmm. but you need the funds to do that. We're in the same boat where we know there's a part of our work and some of the work we're proudest of that we have to ask the community to help us do it. And so a couple of years ago, we started up a nonprofit journalism fund that goes through the Poynter Institute, our nonprofit owner, that goes directly into our newsroom to fund our investigations, our enterprise work, so that the work of our Kratom product or mm-hmm. a project or the lead smelter story, that work can keep being told.
Gotcha.
We just had a great investigative piece on seagrass throughout the state of Florida. Mm-hmm, I don't know if you read mm-hmm. that, but this yep. is all about the runoff that happens from phosphorus mm-hmm. and other chemicals that people put in their lawns and agriculture that gets into our waterways, kills seagrass, and ultimately kills manatee. And this was a multi-year project, and we covered every part of the coastline of Florida. It was the most comprehensive study of this and just how difficult it is to maintain high water quality if there's not more awareness about right. what we're putting into the water.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. So I do want to ask about you and I had the joy of having lunch with you and talking about some of the subject. As I've mentioned before, news is it's a fundamental part of my own makeup. I have a couple of questions I want to ask you, but I'm going to ask a different one to start. What's your view of the media oligarchs that exist today? What are they? Are they moving the conversation forward in important ways, or are they creating? This becomes a really closed question. I didn't mean it to be that way. let me just stop with the question. What do you think of this idea of the rise of the media oligarch? You know, these institutions that control vast amounts of information, whether they're run by an individual or a corporation, it certainly seems that a lot of information channels are owned by a very few people.
I would agree there is some concentration in the industry. The highest levels of concentration in terms of who controls the information we get, I would put in the hands of those that own the platforms, mm-hmm. right? So I'd put those in the hands.
Not the content creators, the platform
correct,
providers.
Right. Yeah, not to say that there aren't large media empires out there, especially mm-hmm. in the broadcast world, but when we think about how everyday citizens get their information, it really is in control by the algorithms that you find on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok. More and more, that is how people get their news and information. And so, is there control over those algorithms? Are there people manipulating those? That's hard to say. I do know that when we look at trust in media, it continues to decrease every year. In fact, media is no different than any other American institution that has been dropping in trust. But I think that when we look at what people consume how they get that information, it is not with traditional brands like the Tampa Bay Times. It's not with traditional brands like TV stations, radio stations. It is more and more they get their news through social channels.
Mm. And so how might we think about the idea? Maybe you can describe to the listener what the Fourth Estate is and why it's been important to us. We talked about Watergate before, but it's something that I think a lot about. And you talked about this a moment ago when you said that the media acts as a check and balance to make sure that accountability is created in communities and with particularly with institutional leaders. Describe the Fourth Estate and describe what you think the state of it is.
Yeah, so the Fourth Estate is actually a European term where they looked at the pillars of society, right? It started with the clergy, you had the nobility, you had the commoners, mm-hmm. right? And then you had the press, right? And it was the thing that served all those other three. And carry that forward to the birth of our nation, right? And our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, said he'd rather have a nation with newspapers, because that was the common media of the mm-hmm. day, rather than government, mm-hmm. right? Rather than the other way around. I'm butchering the quote. But he understood, and I think the founding fathers understood, that you couldn't have a free society without a free press. It is why the press is the only industry named in the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, right? I mean, think about the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, among many other freedoms that individuals have. But they realized that you had to have a way to report on the government in order for that government to operate as best as it could.
Well, and I want to ask you a follow-up question. That so if I go back to this, my Watergate example, what I remember about all of that One, it should be said that it was a time in which elected officials did the right thing for the right reason, right? No matter what side of the aisle you were on. And that left a significant impression on me.
Yeah.
That while a person had done something that most folks would agree was wrong, the system worked as it was designed to. But part of that was because the pressure being put on those folks by media who continued to say, are you aware of? Did you know?
That's
or publish
right.
a story where you know all those politicians were picking up the Washington Post on the next morning going, how do they know that?
Yeah.
Right? So are we losing that? As a society, does that accountability still exist? When you publish something and somebody looks at you and says, well, that's patently untrue, and you know that you have fact-checked it five times, are we losing this as a society? Are you concerned about this?
It does concern me. There are days when I feel like we have slid very far away from the early 70s during Watergate, right? You remember then Nixon hated the press,
yes.
right? Had a great disdain for the press pool and the people reporting on him.
Though he liked tape recorders.
Yeah. Recorded everything.
As it turns
out. Not a good idea. But he was heavily pressured, you know, by the press, but then by the members of his own party who said, we can't let you sink the party. You have to resign, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a good mental exercise is fast forward to today. If Nixon had his own, you know, account on X and could say, have his own microphone to say whatever he wanted, his own Truth Social account, you know, would he have resigned? Would he have felt that political pressure to step away from the office, knowing that the facts of what he did were put in plain sight, but could he spin an alternative narrative to change that? I don't know. What I do know is that I feel like the press still has some weight, still helps carry some of the narrative. And you know, one of the most recent examples, and I'm very proud of this, back to the serving you know this area in the state, is we just had some very good reporting on what's happening in Tallahassee with the Hope Florida Foundation.
That's certainly been interesting to follow.
Right? So, yeah, I would say that there are plenty of people in Tallahassee that don't have a fondness for what we do, certainly in the governor's mansion. I would say that that's probably true. And we are reporting very vigorously on this foundation and the $10 million and where it went ultimately to political action campaigns. And that reporting is not being ignored, right? It is political pressure is being felt. It's taking a lot of twists and turns along the way. But I feel like that really great investigative reporting, specifically from Lawrence Maurer, who heads up our efforts to cover state politics in Tallahassee, it is being felt and it is opening eyes, and I'm proud of that. So I don't think it's gone away. But what I will say is that all public members, whether they're in political office or positions of power, have their own avenues to tell their version of the story. You know, and they should. We don't begrudge them that. But what's concerning is when citizens hear it directly from that person of power, because they're going to have a view that they want to share. And if that's the only thing you absorb, then you get a very distorted view of the world.
It's something that certainly concerns me is the responsibility of accountability, you know, and how do we create that in communities? I would observe about myself that I probably read the same 10 websites every day, which means I'm in an echo chamber, right?
Let me ask you, do you question it? Like for me, if I read something that may not sound so right, you seek another source. For instance, you know, you may have a story that it has this very dramatic picture that doesn't even really match with the story to inflame
something. Right, the Cleveland Food Bank.
Yeah. Do you, from your 10 sites, if you're questioning it, dip out and try to find more information?
I do. For sure. And I think that becomes, so this is a dumb example, but it's an example of AI, I was writing an article for something we want to publish to some of our, you know, investors, key investors, and about what's going on in Washington. And so I, you know, fired up the Googler and punched in some terms, and what comes out is AI, which is very helpful because it's very structured. So at the top of my little Google thing, I don't know if I signed up for this or it's just how it works.
Technology.
Yeah, whatever. Advanced. So get off my lawn. So
yell at some clouds.
So they had terrifically outlined, you know, this is what it is. This is how many. I think I was looking up how many folks use Snap, right? Yeah. In the state of Florida, right? So they had some, and I thought, what's the source of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, where does this come from? Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is AI, but where does that come from?
Yeah, but where is AI getting it?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I know I trust certain voices, and, you know, so I would say without pandering to you, I trust you all.
Yeah.
You know, I trust the local newspaper because I know you. I know the credibility of the work that's been done. But it is difficult. So the story, maybe tell the story of Cleveland Food Bank. Mm.
Yeah, so there was an article that went all over the internet when we talk about the changes in Washington. And, you know, if you're in our world and you understand it and you – no, we have wonderful relationships with our local media partners. But the public was presented with a story that was very brief. But the photo had been doctored, and it was tractor trailers with rotting fruit falling out of it. So I start getting calls from friends that know where I work, know what I do, and they are just like, I can't believe they turned food away. Mm. I can't believe you're not going to be able to feed people. I can't believe, is your job okay? And I'm like, it's fake. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you know? And I'm like, because I live this every day. It's fake. Mm. Yeah. Like, you have to really use your noodle. Like, you have to listen. But also, I believe you have to find your trusted sources, right? We're very fortunate in our world to have these amazing partners, you know, you guys included, that have really helped change Feeding Tampa Bay and gotten our name out there, helped build our reputation, helped share our stories, and better our community. Like you said, we're in the same business together. We're bettering our community. And I believe we couldn't have done it, and maybe it's my role, but I believe we couldn't have done it without the help we've had, or without in COVID when Ev was creating this gorgeous B-roll that we were getting national coverage because we could give them what they wanted. It's just incredible to me.
Yeah.
I'm in awe and enamored of talent and people with wonderful ethics that just want to make sure we're informed or we're being educated.
Yeah. You know, I think kind of we would love to talk about this subject for a while. I think what I would like to make sure, and I had the opportunity to address your colleagues the other day when you all were here on campus. And I, you know, I just want to reiterate that I think the work that you do is important and noble. I hope that your colleagues know that doing the right thing for the right reason is better for all of us, even though some days you all may not get the credit, or worse yet, get the blame. But boy, it sure is important when someone is able to stand up there and say, this is, it's important that we publish information about how our seabeds are, or what's happening, you know, with OSHA violations, or all of those things remain important to us as a community. And boy, we're sure grateful that you guys are willing to do the right thing for the right reason. There's less and less of you across the United States.
Yeah.
And so thanks for standing in defense of truth in our community. I do want to ask you a question again that's not on our list, but who's a writer you follow?
Shocking.
Here's the first.
After the show, we have a debrief, and the debrief will be, Thomas, you talk too much.
Pete, Thomas is the one who insists on the lists. I don't understand. But go ahead. I think that's a great question.
Well, okay, before I answer your question, I wanted to say thank you. Yeah. And can I just do a shameless plug for the facilities here? We had our company meeting here at the Feeding Tampa Bay facilities, and it was just a huge hit. The team loved it.
Good.
So many of them hadn't been out here before, and so they got exposed to it. So thank you for opening up your home to us. It meant a lot.
Yeah, so we're pleased to have you.
And I'm really excited that we're going to be doing there are plans in the works. We're doing events together,
right.
You know, talking about educating, making sure people have all the right information together. Some of that might be super entertaining.
Can I do another shameless plug?
So this happened back in May, but we had a spotlight event on sustainability and the growth in our area. Mm-hmm. So it was just a fantastic place to be. Mm-hmm. Yep. So thank you for
absolutely. And we're going to do more.
Yes, we are. As a partnership, we have some things cooking.
Yeah. That's right.
We do. And so hopefully soon enough, we'll be able to talk about that. But who is a writer you pay attention to in the newsroom? Okay.
In our newsroom or any newsroom?
Like, who's a person you say, so I'm a big fan of Tom Friedman.
Yeah, yeah.
If he writes something, I will make sure that I read it. But
yeah, now Tom Friedman, David Brooks, just such a gifted writer. You know, Ezra Klein has got some wonderful thought leadership on current events. What I love about his podcast, and I'm an avid podcast listener. This is number one.
Right.
Ezra Klein, a distant number two.
But he
always brings on some very thoughtful guests, and they dive deep into topics, and I think that it really helps me absorb things in a way that that's harder to do in written form. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that there's a lot of great work being done by good journalists out there.
So at the end of every episode, we like to ask the same couple of questions of folks because it's kind of an equalizer, but it's also, it reveals. Mm-hmm. As we like to say, everything good in our community and in our lives start around a table or happen mm-hmm. around a table. The conversations you want to have, the people you love, you know, the moments that matter to you are around a table. So you have a table and there's four seats. You're occupying one. Anyone living or dead who is sitting at your table with you?
Yeah, this is, wow, what a question. I'll say Jesus, Muhammad, and Siddhartha, I want answers.
I like that.
Wow.
I got some questions.
need truth.
I'm kidding. Yeah. Oh, that would be an interesting table to sit
on the record.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, this is an interesting one because there's two ways to think about this, right? One is, do you want like the most interesting conversation, right? Or do you want the people who have knowledge and experience that just fascinate you? Mm-hmm. So interesting conversation is probably where I'll go with this because I think my list would be George Carlin, right? Mm. One of the best comedians, the most insightful people on just the human experience and institutions that governed America and the world. And he just, his comedy kind of broke through.
His social commentary.
Yeah, social commentary is just fascinating. And staying in the realm of social commentary, I would say someone with great expertise and just a wonderful wit, Angela Duckworth, if you know who she is. She was really a student of Dana Kahneman, one of the best sociologists ever to live, and really has absorbed so much of his work and shares insights on the human experience and why we click the way we do. I think that there's a great parallel between sociology and journalism to understand how we function together as a society, how humans operate. And so I think she would be a fascinating person at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom. Oh, I want my mom there. I was
12. Is your mom still with us?
No, I lost her when I was 12. Okay. And I would love to spend more time with her.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested too. Maybe it would be your mom. What are you serving and who's cooking?
Oh, I know that. It would be a crawfish boil.
Hmm.
And I would cook.
Okay. Nice.
So my family, half my family.
You have some pretty good guests there. You're
giving
them
crawfish?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine like all these people cracking open crawfish every year?
Yeah, like the open table's good, but I'm not a crawfish girl. But the seafood boil.
You haven't had my crawfish. Yes. Every year I do a big crawfish boil at our house. I just had it a couple of weeks ago. Nice. You are all invited to this.
All right.
Okay.
It's fantastic. It's a fun group. We get together. We eat too much crawfish and probably have too many beers.
It's got to have cold beer goes really good.
And it's a great time. And I think if I had that group with me, that would be a fun way to do it.
That's awesome.
And you'd be cooking for your mom.
That's right.
That'd be pretty amazing.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much, my friend, for taking the time to join us. We look forward to working with you in the future and are just thankful for the TBT, man.
So am I.
You have so many wonderful reporters who we've made friends with and who have really changed our world and those of our neighbors as well. So thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So lots of takeaways from today. This is a personal favorite of mine. I don't get to duck into this world very often, but I'm curious what kind of like big takeaways you guys had from this that you maybe were either surprised or you feel like are just really important for the audience to like keep in their back pocket after this episode.
You go first.
What? Now you want me to talk?
Well, if I started, you'd interrupt me anyway, but go ahead.
Wow.
I'm not even putting on the bloopers. That's staying in.
I think what kind of did such a terrific job is helping tell the story of why the story matters. Mm-hmm. That the responsibility of putting together adhering to journalistic standards is still what matters. Mm-hmm. You know, the examples that he cited about the different stories that they're doing today, and I thought the honorability to use, I don't think that's a word, but the honor of doing a story even when you know it's not going to drive readership.
Right.
Left an impression on me to say, hey, we still have a responsibility to our community that's beyond profit. Mm-hmm. That always, I think, for me, is something that I find noble and important.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll spin off of that a little bit because...
Oh, you don't have your own?
I do, but mine is more journalism is an art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's an art form that takes creativity. You know, you talk about those stories that were told that took a year, dedication, passion for the community, and then you're creating something that makes an impact that changes things for the good.
Yeah,
whether that be getting someone out of office or it's making sure that the fellas that were at the plant are safe or our grasses, our seagrasses, you know, are okay. So although, I just think it's beautiful.
I really wanted to dive into like, how does a reporter really start? Is it like a detective? Like they get a little thread and they start pulling on the thread and they make, I found this out. And do they run into the newsroom and say, guess what I just found out? And then he says, okay,
we're going to go. Do you say that, Conan? Do you say, yes, let's do it?
No, that would be our editor, Mark.
I met Mark. Yeah. I know Mark. Okay.
Yeah.
Does anybody ever have to... Now, here I am. I just said goodbye. But he happens to be
You're
here.
You're in the outro, by the way.
I know. Wait,
you just broke
so
the fourth wall.
I still talk. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do here. Yeah.
He's still here.
I just had to
you weren't supposed to. We were supposed to have him close.
Okay, yeah. Well,
but it just feels rude.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's set up. You're part of this.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Can I share one other insight about how news work?
Yes.
The number of stories that we don't run because they're dead ends, right? The whole let's go thing. Oh, this is juicy. We, you know, the mayor's doing this. You know, the selected official's doing that. The CEO's embezzling this money.
Oh.
Dig in and there's nothing there.
Oh, wow.
Right.
It's dead end.
Yeah.
Right? And just there are piles of these. Piles of these.
So the editor chooses. Are you ever brought in to where it's like they're on the fence?
I'm only brought in when there's
Catherine Graham.
There's a legal concern, right? When there's and we all... Always
y'all know how
very
that is.
Carefully because we go up against organizations with big law budgets.
Right? Yeah.
So we got to be on everything we do, I's dotted, T's crossed.
Yeah.
So when somebody that doesn't usually come through the door, you're like, oh, man.
Right.
Great.
Okay, well, you're going to have to edit this as you see fit.
Good luck with
that. I love
it.
The fourth wall.
It was smooth.
I'm just so interested. I don't want it to end.
It's true. We just don't want
you
to go.
It's so interesting, but alas, we must go.
Mm-hmm.
Hope you guys are having a great summer. That's it for this episode of Stick a Fork in It.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you again.